The following talk, How Progressives Should Approach the Dilemmas of 21st Century Politics, features University of Wisconsin-Madison sociology professor Eric Olin Wright. In this talk, Professor Wright argues that capitalism, by its very nature, undermines core progressive values. Politicians face a dilemma if they try to advance these values by making capitalism work better. The talk ends with ways of dealing with the dilemma. This program was sponsored by the Madison Institute and was held at the Capitol Lakes Health Center Auditorium in Madison on March 10, 2012. Professor Eric Wright.
I'm delighted to be here at an intense gathering of progressives in Madison. What I thought I would do today is not focus on immediate policy debates and questions, but rather on the bigger picture of how progressives should approach the dilemmas of the 21st century, what the broad tasks are, and how to think about that problem. What I'll do is basically discuss four different things. I'll begin by elaborating at least what I think are the core values that underline a progressive politics. Then I want to explain why I think these values are inconsistent with capitalism. That if you take the values seriously, you just have to worry about how to transcend the constraints of a capitalist economy. In the third part of the talk, I'll then explain why I think this poses some really deep dilemmas for progressives. And the key idea there is that progressive politics in the short run are always forced to try to strengthen capitalism because it's the necessary condition for all sorts of things we care about. And yet, in the long run, if you take seriously these values, you have to transcend capitalism. And that's a dilemma. How do you, in the short run, constantly feel the pressure to make capitalism work better, when in the long run, you really want to tame it, contain it within much more narrow scope so that other values can dominate? That's the dilemma I will talk about. And then in the last part of the lecture, I'll have some comments about how to navigate that problem, what kinds of policies, particularly around the question of jobs and employment, how we can think about that problem in a way that doesn't exactly avoid the dilemma, but it softens the dilemma. That's the big agenda here. Okay, part one. What are the values that define a progressive politics? Well, I can't, in a way, answer that question in general because I can't speak for everyone. I'll tell you what I define as the core values of my progressive politics. There are three in particular. The first is a principle of social justice. The second is a principle of democracy. And the third I will refer to as a principle of intergenerational justice, which is less familiar. And that's actually how I think of environmental issues. Not as environmental issues as such, but as a question of intergenerational justice. So let me explain what I mean by each of these. First, the principle of social justice. In a socially just society, all people would have broadly equal access to the social and material means to live a flourishing life. Now, there's a lot packed into that. That's not a kind of simple statement. Let me explain the pieces. First, the start at the end, a flourishing life. There's a lot of things we could care about when we want a just society. We could, so for example, you could say what you really care about is human well-being or welfare or happiness. I use the expression flourishing life to describe the content of what I really care about. There's differences in the implications of different ways of talking about these things. Happiness, for example, has the problem that it's too dependent on an interior state of the person. Whereas human flourishing is a kind of encompassing idea of how people develop their potentials, how they live a life that's fulfilling, develop their talents and ways of living in the world. So all of these terms have problems. I think flourishing is the best one to use. That's the last bit of the statement. Working backwards, social and material means necessary to live a flourishing life. So a just society is not one that simply provides people with the necessary income to live a flourishing life. It also gives people access to the social conditions to live a flourishing life, which means having access to community. Stigma is another issue. So to live a flourishing life is to be freed from stigma. It's to live in a world of respect rather than a world of social status denigration. And that's a separate dimension from just material resources. I then refer to equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. The key word there is access. There's a lot of debate around this point. The standard way of talking about social justice in the United States and in many countries is equal opportunity. I think equal access is better than equal opportunity for a couple of reasons. A lottery, a fair lottery, is equal opportunity. Right, so you could have a society in which 10% of the people live well and live flourishing lives and 90% don't, and it's decided by a lottery where everybody has an equal probability. Well, that's equal opportunity, but it's not equal access. Also, equal opportunity seems to suggest that all the justice issues are front-loaded in early life. It's sometimes called starting gate equality. Which means if you screw up as a teenager, well, too bad, you screwed up. You had an equal opportunity. Equal access is a more generous view of what our ideal is. Equal access to the conditions to live a flourishing life means, in the ideal, we want all people, regardless of whether they screw up, to still have equal access to the conditions to flourish. It means that it's part of the principle of justice that people can overcome their screw-ups, that they have second, third, fourth chances. Human beings should just have broadly equal access to the conditions to flourish. That's my principle of social justice. By the way, I also mean all people, the all people part of that. Now, that's a very demanding condition. I mean all people. I don't mean all Americans or all Madisonians. I mean all people. This is a global principle of justice. We live in an unjust world when it is the case that some people, by the accident of birth, have access to the conditions to live a flourishing life, and some people don't. That's an injustice, in my view, not just a misfortune. It's an injustice. And therefore, global redistribution, global development, all of these things are in play in discussions of social justice. Okay, that's the first principle. Second principle is the principle of democracy. All people should have broadly equal access to the necessary means to meaningfully participate in decisions which affect their lives. When these decisions affect us as separate persons, when the question is, how do you participate in decisions which affect you and only you, that's what we mean by individual freedom and liberty. The idea of liberty, freedom, is you should have control over the decisions that affect you, but don't affect other people. If they also affect other people, then those other people should be part of the participation in those decisions, and we call that democracy. Now, this is an important point because it means, since we live in such interdependent ways with other people, that there's a whole range of decisions in which we have to jointly make those decisions. We have to draw the line somewhere. The terms we use to draw that line is private versus public. Right, so private matters are the ones that you should be left alone to decide yourself. Public matters are the ones that should be made through some collective process. But that line of distinction between the public and the private, it's ultimately arbitrary. By arbitrary, I mean there's no magical way you can just say this is the distinction. Let me give just a little example. I give this example to my students because they like examples that involve sex. So so the example that I give, what adult people do in the privacy of their own homes is up to them. I don't want to have any public interference with sexual practices among consenting adults. On the other hand, sex in midday in a public park, I think, is appropriately regulated. And the reason is because it doesn't just affect the people participating in it. So that's a case where their decision to engage in sexual activity in a public park in midday, in the playground of an elementary school, let's really make this sound, yeah. it affects other people, and therefore the other people or their representatives, in the case of the elementary school kids, should be part of the decision as to whether they want to allow this or not. It's not a private choice anymore. So the public-private distinction is important, but it's a practical matter. It's a question of how you collectively decide where to draw this line. The core value that we care about, I think, is common to both. That is, people should control the decisions which affect them. That gives us the basis of a notion of liberty, and it gives us a basis for understanding collective decisions. When conservatives talk about that they're all for liberty and freedom, and therefore the owner of a factory should be allowed to close it down and move it wherever he wants or wherever she wants, they are violating the value which they proclaim to be defending, because that's a decision that massively affects the lives of other people, and you're excluding them from participation in the decision. So conservative defenders of freedom typically, I think, are deeply confused about the value that they are announcing. That is, they don't understand its intimate connection with collective choice, not just individual choice. The principle of democracy, then, is that all people should have broadly equal access to such decisions, both as they affect themselves separately and as they affect themselves as members of communities of different sorts. Broadly equal access. Certainly in the United States, we are a quite undemocratic society with respect to this way of understanding what democracy means. The third value I call a principle of intergenerational justice. Now, in the statement of the value, there's no mention of the environment. But this is the core, I think, of an environmental ethic, of environmental values. I would state this value as follows. Future generations should have access to the social and material means to live flourishing lives at least at the same level as the present generation. And this is the value that underlies the importance of environmental sustainability. I'm opposed to global warming not because of some non-human-centered reason why I care about the environment, but because this is bad for the world in which we live, potentially catastrophically bad. And the way to express that badness, I think, is especially around intergenerational justice. We're not leaving the world a place that will be as conducive to human flourishing as the world in which we arrived. All right, those are my three principles. Well, why, if you take these values seriously, does this mean, if you follow through the implications, that you are a critic of capitalism? In what ways does capitalism block the realization of these values? Okay, let me just very briefly give you the kind of short form account of this. In the book Envisioning Real Utopias, the longest chapter is What's So Bad About Capitalism, is what it's called. So first on social justice. Social justice is all people should have equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. Capitalism inherently generates forms of inequality that systematically violate social justice. It's intrinsic to capitalism that it distribute resources in such a way that some people have vastly more access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life than other people. That's not an accidental byproduct of capitalism. It's intrinsic in the way a competitive market economy will generate inequalities of access of individuals to resources. This is most transparently the case for children. Some children are born into families that are poor, others are born into families that are rich, and there is no way in the world you can say this doesn't affect their access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. Even if you take equal opportunity as your criterion, so even if we pull back from this more expansive, generous notion of equal access and say, okay, what about equal opportunity? Again, there's just no way you can say a kid born in a central city in the United States in the year 2012 and a kid born in a wealthy suburb have equal opportunity to live a flourishing life. And that's a consequence of organizing an economy in a way in which people's claims on resources are based on their competitive positions within markets, and the resources they can bring to markets determine the resources they get out of markets. That's an intrinsic consequence of that kind of economic organization. Secondly, democracy. Vast domains of decisions, which hugely affect the lives of people, they are legally excluded from participating in. They're prevented from being part of the deliberation and discussion of what should be done around all sorts of things that massively affect their lives. And that's undemocratic. It's kind of just sorely straightforward. When you have a system of strong private property rights that are organized not just around the private property over the things which you consume, but private property in resources that are used cooperatively, collectively, to produce, that is, private property in the means of production, when you allow people to privately decide when and where and how to use their resources for economic activity, you are saying they have the right to impose consequences on other people's lives without consulting and discussing and working it out with them. But of course, there are lots of other ways that capitalism impinges on democracy, Citizens United being the current symbol of one of the worst. That is, it allocates private wealth to people in ways in which they're allowed to deploy their private wealth for political purposes. And that violates the principle of equal access to the means to participate in the decisions which affect our lives. Some people have more access to the means to participate, namely they can allocate huge amounts of money. The Koch brothers in Wisconsin, they're not even from Wisconsin, notoriously have much greater access to the means to affect public policy decisions than the average person. And that's also a violation of democracy. I would finally add the workplace itself, the fact that workplaces are largely organized as dictatorships, where people are told what to do and have no control over the conditions of their own labor within work, that's also a violation of democracy. Okay, sustainability. Well, this has become increasingly crucial. I think capitalism inherently threatens the quality of the environment for future generations because of the imperative intrinsic to capitalism to grow. That is, the growth imperative of capitalism is not, it's not a secondary feature. It's essential for capitalism to grow in order for it to reproduce itself. So this gets into more technical political economy kinds of questions. If you have an economic system, the question is, what are the conditions which make it possible to sustain it over time? That's called reproduction. How do you reproduce an economic system over time? The distinctive thing about capitalism is that the condition for its reproduction is its expansion. Growth is a condition for its very reproduction. That's why when we have an economic crisis like we've had now in the last years, what's the thing that everybody's worried about? How do we restart growth? You know, if you think about it from an environmental point of view, the financial crisis could have been a fantastic opportunity to say, at last, thank God, the economy is shrinking. You know, we're producing way too much stuff in the rich parts of the world. At last, we can pull back. Let's use the opportunity of the financial crisis to have a degrowth economy and then figure out how can people live well in an economy that's shrinking. Well, there's lots of ways people could live well in an economy that's shrinking. We could redistribute work. We could reduce work weeks. We could say no more mansions because the kinds of economic resources needed to support palatial houses is just too costly for the environment. There's Juliet Shore, a wonderful, she's somebody you should invite sometime. She's fantastic. She's a sociologist at in Boston. She's written a series of very, very good books, The Overworked American, The Overspent American, a bunch of very nice books. She did a calculation, the following calculation. If you took the standard of living of Americans in 1960, which at the time was the highest in the world, and the average, the median person in the United States in 1960 lived comfortably. So if we took the average standard of living, or the median material standard of living of 1960. And if all productivity growth since 1960 to the year 2000 had been turned into increased free time rather than increased stuff, so you increase productivity, means it takes less inputs to produce the same output. That's what more productive means. Less hours of work to produce the same output. So if all of that productivity from 1960 to 2000 went into increased free time, the average work week would have been 15 hours by 2000. Now, if you ask somebody in 1960, which would you prefer, to double your consumption or to cut your work week in half? You can live the same standard of living now. You only have to work 20 hours for it. Which would you prefer? When people look prospectively, they always opt for less work at the same consumption. That is, by survey, the survey data is unequivocal. That most people, I'm not talking about somebody who's unemployed or somebody who's in a very insecure job, but the kind of, what in the 1960 would be the kind of middle class, middle income person. If you ask, I'll give you a choice. 20 years from now, you can work just as hard as you're working now and consume twice as much, or you could only work 20 hours a week and have the same standard of living now, have all that free time. People prefer free time over more consumption prospectively, but not retro. If you ask, would you accept a 50% cut in your pay to work half as much time, people say no. Well, that's because of the way in which people's expectations adapt to their means. Needs, experience needs increase. The social standards change, and your sense of what you have, how well you have to live in order to live a kind of respectable life changes. So voluntary simplicity, which is the term used to describe people who do opt for more time and less consumption, is a pretty demanding thing for most people because it implies breaking with cultural standards. And, you know, as a sociologist, this is sociology 101, right? Cultural standards are not loosey-goosey things. They really affect people's lives. They really shape how people respond to these kinds of questions. Well, the point here, though, is sustainability of the environment, intergenerational justice, requires an economy that is less driven by growth and consumption, and yet that's growth and consumerism is intrinsic, not accidental. It's not just a possible feature of capitalism, it's intrinsic to it. So those are the reasons why I think, among others, if you take those values seriously, you become a critic of capitalism. You might in the end say, I'm a critic of capitalism, but I think it's still the best we can do. It doesn't follow from identifying capitalism as a source of harms that you want to replace it. I mean, you might want to. Your utopian desire might be, but your real utopian, practical, pragmatic views might still end up saying it's the best we can do. My book, Envisioning Real Utopias, is mostly about why it's not the best we can do. The next part of the talk was on the dilemmas that all this poses for progressive politics. But first, maybe if there are questions or issues people want to raise around the critique of capitalism.
Dave Stephenson. I was contemplating the other day, why in the heck, at my age, mid-70s, which is aged but not ancient, why life is so much more difficult now than it was when I went off to college. And one thing I had forgotten almost, we have doubled the population of human beings on this planet just in that period of time. Doubled twice. That's an amazing amount of people. And there is a concept in natural science of the carrying capacity of the Earth.
The question of whether at the root of all of these environmental dilemmas is sheer population growth, whether that's the right diagnosis, or the socioeconomic system in which that population engages in cooperative economic activity, that's a difficult thing to sort out. Paul Ehrlich, in the 1970s, wrote the early 70s, right? The Population Bomb.
Right.
Yeah. wrote The Population Bomb. And at that point, his diagnosis was that the problem was population, people. He's changed his views. He thinks the problem is consumerism and capitalism now. That you observe that whenever poor countries develop, population growth plummets because people don't need the insurance of large families for old age. And he feels that the problem is consumerism, that is overconsumption, not per se too many people.
Kai Fouché, that equal access is wonderful, but people are not equal. You cannot have a democracy in a planet where a bunch of people will make decisions on things that they know nothing about.
The democratic principle is everyone should have equal access to the necessary means to meaningfully participate in decisions which affect their lives. The reason why we have forms of representation for some kinds of decisions is we want the meaningful then is that I should be able to meaningfully participate in choosing the people who make the technical decisions that affect my lives. So in Mondragon, the workers' cooperative in the Basque Country, the workers elect the managers. The workers create committees. They choose committees that monitor the technical staff. But those committees don't make all the technical decisions. They have experts who make those decisions. But the experts are accountable to the workers. They're not accountable to stockholders. Whenever there are big strategic questions about the direction of the cooperatives, then the workers' assemblies get into full gear, and there's lots of participation, of direct involvement and discussion over key strategic decisions.
Okay, and that gets to another question I want to ask you, which is what does all this pose in terms of dilemmas for progressive?
Oh, that happens to be part three of the of the talk. Progressives are people who wish to advance these core values of social justice, democracy, and sustainability. To do this means that we have to curtail and challenge capitalism through various kinds of public policy, if my criticisms of capitalism are correct. But to be in a position to shape public policy, progressives have to win elections. And to win elections, they have to promise policies that strengthen capitalism. That's the fundamental dilemma. Thus, there's a deep contradiction between the short-term imperatives of competing politically under the rules of the game in which we live and the long-term objectives for realizing progressive values. One solution to that is to deny that the long-term objective is to transform the system. So there is what I think of as an illusion that if we just continually strengthen capitalism, we will get enough of these values realized that it'll be a good thing.
Through regulation, you mean?
Well, through all sorts of things. Regulation would be one form of this. Higher taxes to create public goods would be another. I think, actually, the most important failure in the last 30 years, really think the problem is the denigration of public goods. The fact that the idea of public goods has been so battered. So even the notion of public education as a public good is under assault. And the idea that, if we just had vouchers and anybody could go to private schools, that would be even better. And so public money would be used to underwrite a market for education, as opposed to education as a public good, we have to collectively provide it in the best way we can. The attack on public goods, I think, has been the kind of the most serious erosion of the democratic spirit, because public goods are what underwrites the idea that we're a community with collective interests to provide for these goods for all. So let me pose this dilemma more explicitly, even though I've already mentioned this, with respect to the question of the environment. So here's the contradiction which underlies the dilemma. Capitalism as an economic system depends upon endless economic growth and the continual expansion of consumption. The imperative has been felt very sharply in this recent financial crisis. The whole political debate is over what's the best way to get the economy growing again. There's not a whiff in the current political debate about whether getting the economy growing again is actually what we want. It's all about how do we get the economy growing. And that's because the only way to get unemployment down is for the economy to expand, as opposed to redistribute work among existing workers or other devices by which we could imagine we could increase employment. One of the strong arguments by Obama supporters to re-elect Obama over the potential Republican opponents is precisely that Republican policies will be worse for restoring the conditions of growth. That's the guts of the economic debate that's going on. And that's not just because people don't understand how things work. That's because they do understand how things work. They're not incorrect in their diagnosis under these conditions. That's how you create jobs. But the contradiction is that the sustainability of the natural environment is not compatible with economic growth. Even if you think that some growth now is still compatible with the survival of the planet, endless growth can't be. We live in a finite universe with finite resources. Endless growth is simply not compatible with the sustainability of the environment. And the sustainability of the environment for the conditions of human flourishing. Remember, add that bit onto my, at least, take on this question. For a sustainable world, at least in the rich countries, we have to shift from a dynamic based on growth, from an economy in which human well-being is contingent upon growth, to one in which it's an economy that's based on free time. That is, the central objective of the economy is to maximize the available time people have to live their lives rather than the amount to maximize the stuff they consume. We need an economy that creates, to use a word by a British, I believe he's an economist, but I'm not sure, Tim Jackson. We need prosperity without growth. I think prosperity without growth requires a non-capitalist economic system. I actually think what we need is prosperity with negative growth. We need degrowth in the rich world, not degrowth in the poor regions of the world. They don't have the basic infrastructure to have the material conditions to live a flourishing life, but in the rich world we need degrowth. So the dilemma for progressive politics is that in order to realize its core values, it has to curtail capitalism and ultimately transcend it, but in order to win elections, it has to pursue policies that strengthen capitalism and encourage growth. This is not because of short-sighted thinking. You know, it's not just because the political actors are myopic. It is inherent in the way the system works, so long as the basic way that economic security and jobs are created is through profit-maximizing investments by private wealth holders on the market. So long as that's the mechanism, and that is the mechanism for jobs in capitalism, that private wealth holders, trying to maximize their returns, decide, should I or should I not invest my money? And so long as that's the way in which the economic well-being of most people is achieved and the jobs are created, then stimulating growth and creating a positive business climate for people to invest is the necessary condition for jobs. I call this a dilemma because it forces such intolerable choices on a coherent progressive politics. If progressives refuse to support policies that economic growth, you know, that support it, if they stand up and say, no, we must stop and refuse to support such policies, then they become politically marginalized and would never win elections and never be able to accomplish anything. If we support policies that promote growth, we intensify the environmental problems in the long run. Now, we can try to minimize the damage by having accompanying policies that try to deal with the negative ramifications of our core policies. So we can have energy efficiency policies that counteract the growth to some extent. We can have fuel standards for automobiles raised as a way of reducing the carbon emissions from cars and the use of fossil fuels. But so long as we have a transportation system that is fundamentally an automobile-based system, those are really just shaving off on the margins. They're not counteracting the dynamic properties of the system, which is requiring the exhaustion of the natural carrying capacity of the world. Where, again, I think it's the consumerist aspect that's the real carrying capacity problem. The question then is, this is the world we are in. We can piss and moan about it, pull our hair out, or we can try to figure out ways in which we can somehow or other navigate it. Ways of thinking about alternatives and how we can package these alternatives within whatever pragmatic policies we have to do to get elected. So I do hope that American capitalist growth rates are in the 2 to 3% rate for the next few years, even though I'd prefer them to be in the minus 5% rate, right? And then the question is, can we combine other policies, other ways of thinking about longer-term strategies that might at least begin to open up a space for alternatives? And that's my fourth part of the lecture. In Denmark, there's a term that's been introduced to describe a really innovative form of dealing with these issues. They call it flexicurity. So the idea is that you encourage automation, displacement of unskilled work, you encourage all this stuff because it's good in the aggregate. But then you have to have a really active policy for creating new jobs, for retraining people, for giving them economic security to bridge between different jobs that they hold. So the idea is that you create employment security but not job security. So people have very short spells of unemployment and lots of retraining, but they have no particular attachment to any given job. They don't have job security, they have employment security. Well, something along those lines, I think, is what one would want, as opposed to the way we do it here. Let me focus on one domain where we can think about this problem of how to navigate these dilemmas and at least begin thinking about building alternatives. And it's around the problem of job creation, around jobs. Now, in this discussion, I'm going to use job as a way of describing income-generating activity, income-generating work. So there's lots of work that people do that doesn't generate income. That's another matter. I'm asking the question, how should we think about the problem of creating work that generates income that people need to for their basic material conditions? Republicans and Democrats alike have bought into the view that the key problem for creating jobs is to create private sector jobs generated by capitalist investment. There's no disagreement between the two parties that the core of the job creation problem is how do we get private capitalist firms to create jobs. Since private investments generate jobs, Republicans argue, if you increase taxation on potential sources of investment, you reduce the prospects for job creation. So the Republican argument against taxation is largely via its claims that this is bad for creating jobs. That's the guts of the Republican argument. There's a secondary argument of a more purely libertarian variety, which is taxation is theft, you know, so that it's immoral anyway. But the main argument against it is that it's bad for jobs. Democrats have sometimes agreed with that and just disagreed on how much you should cut taxes, and other times have disagreed with that particular claim that taxing the rich hurts jobs, because they argue if you use those taxes in various ways to increase demand in the market, if you use those taxes to improve infrastructure, the use of those taxes could actually increase jobs. But it's still, the target is how do we have public policies to create private sector jobs generated by capitalist investment. I think this is a fundamentally flawed way of understanding the problem of job creation. Jobs within capitalist firms are only one kind of job, even in a capitalist society, and it shouldn't be given exclusive attention in our approach to the problem. So if the problem is how do we create sufficient jobs, capitalist firms are one way, but only one way. In a complex economy like ours, there are a whole variety of other job-creating processes that exist already and which provide alternatives to capitalist-generated employment. So four of these alternatives, I think, are especially relevant. The most obvious alternative is public sector employment, an important way in all capitalist societies that jobs are created is by governments directly employing people. I'm employed. I'm a professor at the university, a state employee. Public sector jobs are jobs. They're not something else. They generate income. They provide for goods and services, depending upon the particular character of the job. So one way you can create jobs is to say we need public sector jobs. In the Great Depression, a huge expansion of public sector jobs was one of the key things. And whenever you go to one of the old national parks, you still enjoy the relics of the jobs that were created by the Civilian Conservation Corps 70 plus years ago. All right, so public sector employment is one of the ways that jobs can get created in a capitalist economy. Another way is worker-owned cooperatives. Now, that's pretty small in the United States. There are parts of the world where it's not so small. In no capitalist economy are they a major sector. But there are regions in some parts of the capitalist world where they're pretty important. In the middle band of Italy, for example, Emilia-Romagna, in that region of Italy, which is the most prosperous part of Italy, with the lowest unemployment, with the most robust economy, that economy is anchored in worker-owned firms. When you read it in the business press, they refer to them as small firms, small and medium firms. They don't point out that they're also worker-owned firms. The example that I've studied the most is Mondragon in the Basque Country. Mondragon is a worker-owned firm. It has about 100,000 people working in these worker-owned firms. There's 270 cooperatives in Mondragon that form a confederation. So the term Mondragon is actually a conglomerate of 270 separate co-ops that then form a kind of co-op of co-ops. One of the key things in Mondragon as a worker-owned cooperative is that there is a worker-owned cooperative bank. One of the cooperatives is a bank, and it's a regular bank. You know, people have deposits, they do their banking thing. The Mondragon Worker Cooperative Bank is not like a credit union. That is, the employees of the credit union don't own the credit union. The depositors own the credit union officially. The Mondragon Worker Cooperative Bank is owned by the workers in the bank with a stakeholder board of directors. So all the other cooperatives in Mondragon have representatives on the board of directors of this cooperatively owned bank. Well, that's important in Mondragon because it helps solve what's a very big problem for worker cooperatives, which is failures in the credit market to provide adequate loans for cooperatives to be stable and to be adequately capitalized. Worker-owned cooperatives are not capitalist firms. They're market firms, but capitalism and markets are not the same thing. Capitalism is a particular way of organizing markets in which resources get allocated by private investors in order to maximize their profits. Worker-owned cooperatives are not investor-based private firms. They're market firms, but they're owned by their workers, and they don't have great incentives to grow. That's a key thing, that worker-owned cooperatives want to remain moderate-sized and then form associations of cooperatives to solve problems of economies of scale through confederation rather than through growth. So worker-owned cooperatives is another way that jobs can get created. A third way that jobs can get created, I think, is less familiar probably to most of you. It goes by the term the social economy. It includes a wide range of not-for-profit economic organizations, but it's not exactly the same as nonprofit. A lot of what is sometimes called social enterprises fall under the social economy. In the United States today, there's some really interesting developments in the social economy, which most people aren't very aware of, that center around the emergence of pretty dynamic urban agriculture in some big cities, particularly cities that have been devastated by the last 25 years of the abandonment of the center city. So Detroit is probably the most well-known example. The population of Detroit has plummeted. There are vast areas of abandoned housing and abandoned land. And in the last decade or so, there's been a significant development of urban agriculture inside the city limits. Now the question is, how is this organized? One of the ways of organizing urban agriculture is to create land trusts, so to take the land out of the market, to have the land controlled by a community land trust. And then for locally based, community-oriented agricultural production to take place, in part also, in the case of Detroit, to deal with the what's called the food desert problem, the problem of inadequate food in the inner parts of the city. Well, this is just emerging. There's some in Chicago. There's a big initiative in Chicago this coming year around this. Some in Milwaukee, Growing Power, something I think some of you may have heard of in Milwaukee. But various efforts to create a non-capitalist sector of agriculture production that also generates employment, income-generating economic activity, but that's oriented to meeting the needs of people in a community rather than maximizing profits. That's the social economy. And the fourth way that jobs get created is people create their own jobs, individual, autonomous freelancing, what is often called self-employment, is another way that jobs get created. People can't find a job, so they create their own job. And they don't then work for an employer. They directly try to produce goods and services of one sort or another for people who want to employ them, for their clients, in effect. Freelancing and self-employment is another way of creating jobs. Now, in American capitalism, there is very little institutional support for freelance, self-employed kinds of work, for people to create their own job and be able to make an adequate living at it. But there's some, and one can easily imagine ways in which this could be improved. The simplest thing that would expand the possibilities of people living reasonable lives by creating their own jobs, simplest thing that would make that better would be universal health insurance. You know, the big obstacle that people face to creating their own jobs is health care. You know, hopefully the Obama plan, however half-baked it is, it's still better than what we had before. But there's other things one could imagine for that would tremendously expand the possibility of self-generated jobs. And one of the proposals which I find most appealing and which also would expand in a very dynamic way the possibility of worker co-ops is to adopt a system of unconditional basic income. This is a pretty radical proposal, but nevertheless I think it's a kind of core progressive, should be a core part of the progressive menu of things that advance our values. An unconditional basic income means that every legal resident of whatever the boundaries of the basic income is, let's say if this was a national project, a national basic income, every legal resident gets a basic subsistence grant every month. They get a basic income that's sufficient to live at the poverty level or just above the poverty line. So everybody gets their basic needs met, unconditional on anything.
Didn't Nixon want that?
A version, something that was called the Family Assistance Plan, the negative income tax, was almost voted in the United States. They're similar. They're part of a family of policy proposals. Let me just tell you how an unconditional basic income works. So everybody gets a core income that's independent of their participation in markets. So it's the equivalent of unconditional basic health care, which every other country besides the United States provides to its citizens, that's independent of their participation in markets. You don't have to engage in markets to have full access to basic health care in most places besides the United States. It's similar to what at least is officially our standard with respect to education. Everybody has unconditional access to basic education, irrespective of their participation in markets. That is, it's as a right of residency that you have access to this basic service. Well, an unconditional basic income simply says that this central idea that some of our needs should be met independently of our performance in markets, some of our needs should be met,
as an unconditional right. Now, the idea of unconditional basic income is that everybody gets it. Bill Gates gets it. I get it. A homeless person in Madison gets it. Everybody gets it. Of course, it means that the taxes on people who generate income through the market, their taxes go up. So I would be a net contributor to basic income. My taxes would rise more than my basic income. Other people would be net recipients of basic income. It has the following properties, which are, I think, very attractive. So one is, because it's not means tested, everybody gets it. There's no stigma attached to it. Another thing that's desirable about it is that people move back and forth across the boundary between being net contributors and net recipients over the life course. It just depends upon how much income you're generating in the market, whether in the end your overall net income is higher or lower by virtue of your basic income. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. It means the coalition of people who feel that this is yes in their interests is quite large. There are some people who are affluent who know that they are always net payers, and there are some people who are always net recipients, but a very large proportion of the population move back and forth. And that expands the political coalition for it. Another, I think, extremely important consequence of basic income is that it makes worker cooperative firms much more stable. One of the big problems to form a worker cooperative is that workers don't have huge savings, that in the course of developing a cooperative and having it learn how to do its activities and become stable and also learning how to cooperate, because it's the democratic processes within cooperatives are not simple, workers still have to eat. The members of a worker cooperative still have to eat while they're doing it. What a basic income does is create time. It gives a longer time horizon for being able to get a small business that's worker-owned up and running effectively, because there's a guaranteed stream of income coming to the members of the cooperative during the course of development. It also makes the viability of cooperatives less risky, which will make it easier for worker cooperatives to get bank loans. So there's this nice kind of feature that the credit market problems that worker co-ops face, because banks see co-ops as very risky, is partially solved by giving an unconditional basic income to its members, because then the co-op is less risky. It's less depends upon how much revenue is generated right up front at the beginning. And therefore, banks, in their ordinary mundane risk assessment for whether they should do loans and what the interest rate should be, will be more favorable to worker co-ops. So, in terms of a policy proposal, I think unconditional basic income is an extremely good one with respect to stimulating three of the four. It's also good for social economy enterprises. You know, if a social economy enterprise that's trying to directly produce to meet social needs of one sort or another and is not driven by trying to make profits, nevertheless still has to provide income for its members, and social economy activities would be tremendously helped by unconditional basic income. My younger daughter is a theater director in Philadelphia. She produces theater with a wonderfully imaginative and creative company that she helped found. And her whole passion is to produce to meet a human need. She's not trying to maximize profits. She tries to sell the tickets, but the tickets are just to cover part of the costs of producing. It's very much a social economy enterprise, her company, because its purpose is to directly produce something that will satisfy a human need, an aesthetic and cultural need that her theater work does. Well, a basic income would be an incredible boon to her capacity to produce her theater. Yeah.
By Alan Brown, there'd be a disincentive for people getting this basic income to work. But aside from that, this would be a huge
increase in cost, which would result in a larger deficit. Do you have any idea of how much this is going to add to the deficit?
Well, it won't add anything to the deficit if you raise taxes appropriately to pay for it. So it is redistributive. It is taking from the rich and giving to everybody else. So taxes increase by more than the basic income for most people who earn incomes. Yeah, this would be a large increase in taxes, which we are a grossly undertaxed nation. Our taxes should be probably a minimum of 15% higher of GDP than they are. In Sweden, taxes account for about 45% of GDP, and it has a lower rate of unemployment than we have, and a more stable economy, and richer public goods, and people live well there. If you think of your total material conditions of life as a combination of private consumption and your consumption of public goods, you can have the same quality of life by having, in material terms, I'm just speaking not in spiritual or other terms, just in practical, ordinary, mundane standard of living terms, you can have fantastic public libraries with comfortable reading rooms and smaller houses, or you can have palatial houses and crappy public libraries. You know, these are different ways that you can organize the material conditions of life for people. Sweden has very high taxation. Denmark has not as high as Sweden, but has relatively high taxation, and they produce public goods out of it. An unconditional basic income is a kind of public good. One way to think of it is it's a freedom grant. It's giving real freedom for everybody. It's helping to satisfy some of that equal access to the material and social conditions notion by giving everybody this basic capacity to act in the world. But here's the thing about the work incentive. It doesn't create any disincentive for work. That is, means-tested programs, that is, if you give money to poor people, conditional upon them being poor, that creates disincentives to work because they lose the benefit if they work. A universal basic income creates no disincentive for work. It reduces the pressure on people to find work that they don't like. That's true. But that's not the same as a disincentive to work. And by subsidizing self-employment and subsidizing worker co-ops and subsidizing the social economy, it will create the possibility of expanding jobs in those sectors, all of which are committed in one way or another to jobs that are also enhancing to people's lives. People create self-employed jobs in part to create jobs in which they flourish more. Now, what's the equilibrium, to use an economist term? I think the equilibrium of such a system will be a lower standard of living in the society, on average, but a much more equally distributed standard of living. But that's a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a good thing if this can underwrite people saying, yes, I want to live my life in a way in which I have my basic needs met, I generate some additional income in order to have discretionary income for an occasional trip to the Caribbean or whatever. But I'm going to put more of my life's energy and time into doing things that contribute to flourishing rather than to more consumption. An unconditional basic income has one of its advantages is that it's more consistent with an environmentally sustainable world than a world in which the only way you get income is by competing in a profit-maximizing market. Of course, this is silent on the political question. How in the hell in the United States, when we can't even get health benefits, can we get an unconditional basic income? That's why I said this is part of the menu of what I think progressive politics should include.
Thank you.
This talk was given by Eric O. Wright. You may want to visit his homepage at the University of Wisconsin website, www.wisc.edu. Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.